Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Full or part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
And here we go. The Media Project is back on the air for another week, and hopefully we'll make some sense this week out of what's going on in the news. I'm Ira Fussfeld, the publisher of the Daily Freeman of Kingston, New York, joined by Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, Professor Emeritus at the State University. And sitting in this week is Mike Spain, the managing editor of the Times Union of Albany. Welcome, Mike.
Happy to be here.
He's going to play the role of Rex Smith, but probably better, don't you think?
Well, I think you've made a couple of really bad mistakes already.
The program is 33 seconds old.
You said, and I heard you say, you did it. You said that it will make some sense this week. By implication, we haven't made sense last week, and the only person who's missing deductively is Rex. So you probably were taking a shot at Rex from last week.
Well, that is something that could be deduced, and we could put a team of reporters on that and see if we come to that similar conclusion. But I think...
Except there is no more team of reporters anyway.
Well, we don't like to be the subject of news stories at the Times Union unless the word Pulitzer is in the story.
I see. And sadly for you, as well as for me, that has not happened in too often, although Rex has been on the committee to judge the Pulitzer.
I know, and you're not allowed to vote on your own entries.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask Mike, who's a wonderful friend of the station, who's on a lot, analyzing the news and the rest of it. Mike, I wondered if you would tell us exactly what a managing editor does.
Well, let me correct you. My role is officially associate editor.
That's
a very vague term.
So sorry, Mike.
No, my fault. I thought it was managing editor.
I'm so sorry.
Well, but the associate editor gets to be a newsroom administrator, handle personnel, budgets. I work with the folks who produce the print edition, the copy editors and the layout editors, the artists and the photographers report to me, and then I interface with the rest of the building.
If Rex wanted to lay up there in bed, you know, and just dawdle, you'd handle it all, right?
Well, I'm there to step in as needed. But he's usually there early and goes home late. So,
you know, it's surprising it's not necessarily a recent development, but there was a time when you'd say the editor of the paper is the person who runs the paper. And then there were all these sort of subset editors, the titles of which almost didn't mean anything. Now you could go, your title associate editor and what you do at another newspaper could be called in something entirely different. Consistent title. But the thing that is coming along now is that a number of newspapers are installing the title content editor as an acknowledgement of the digital world that we're going
through. Right, and we do use that title at the Times Union, and it does recognize that there's a group of people that produce content. It's sort of platform agnostic.
Yes, cool.
They collect information. They put it in perspective. They get it ready for distribution, first to the web and then into the print edition. They can use it to produce an audio or a video, and editors will go over that content and make sure it's ready for prime time. And those are content editors, and they're not just specifically working on the print edition anymore.
And of course, the public could care less.
Right. And what they care about is whether you're accurate and whether your words are spelled correctly and whether your grammar is correct. Right.
And most of all, whether the paper gets to their porch.
Exactly what I was going to say, whether the paper's delivered on time.
In fact, the managing editor, our very good friend Kevin Moran at the Berkshire Eagle, on his thing, you know, when you call his phone and he doesn't answer, it always says, "And if this is about a paper not reaching, please call so-and-so at such-and-such."
Well, there's no question that the editor, or whatever the top editor's name title is often considered by many in the public as really the person who runs the entire company. In other words, I think I always have thought that that was a throwback to their school experience when the editor of the school paper ran the paper. There was no such thing as a publisher of the school paper. So that editors, and I remember when I was the editor of my paper in the early 80s, that I would get those calls. My paper was late today. And I would say, no, well, okay, I'll forward you to the circulation guy. And they said, well, isn't that your job? And isn't that the publisher's job? It's the editor is the one who runs the paper.
Well, people today are just happy to get a voice on the other end so that they can talk about the problem that they're having. And usually we'll be sympathetic and then pass them to the appropriate person in the delivery department, as we call it, for them.
So, but I love the way you sort of talked about Rex's role and your role. And I love the idea that, you know, you're very deferential to Rex. And also, you also have to be the bad guy with everybody underneath you because, you know, that's what the tough guy is. So the bad cop has to do. Put it another way, Mike, are you the bad cop?
Well, actually, we're all pretty good to the people that work at the Times Union. You know, I'm part of a team of senior editors that Rex turns to implement and promulgate his view of journalism in Albany. And I don't think there's too much...
Well, who's the bad cop at WAMC?
Yeah, good question, Alan.
It's tough.
You're so closely associated as you should be.
We have a number of bad cops. So here's the thing. You always have to protect the flag in all these organizations. You don't want the guy who is running, you don't want George Hearst to be the bad guy in the Times Union. No, says Mike, he's nodding his head very vigorously.
And certainly not.
You certainly don't. And you don't want Rex to be. So they have to have basically a nameless bureaucrat who is the bad guy so that nobody can say, you know, the person who runs your operation is the bad guy. So here, I'm the bad guy too often because I lose my temper on the telephone with people. And that's not a good thing. I have somebody who is trying to get a from down your way, a guy onto the radio, mm-hmm. calls here every day. This guy calls every day. Now he's got this, I can't say that because I don't know for sure, but he's got this woman calling all the time and trying to say, how come we don't have him on more and all the rest? They're lobbying us to get him on more. And, you know, I'm not calling her back right now. This is a message because if I do, I'm going to let her have it. Mm. And I know the Chartok twins were famous for that in their early youth, and that you should probably avoid it because it never helps at all.
Well, as I pointed out to those who don't know you and those who do know you already knew this, that you do not shy away from a fight. And sometimes you go looking for them, and that works for you. I mean, it's look at your long and glorious career.
Well, but it also can create enemies for one, so that if you're talking to somebody, let's give you a thing. Let's just say you're... You know, at the Hudson Opera House, and a lady comes up to you. Perfectly nice lady.
This is the hat story. No. That was the other one.
And she wants to tell you about why she's angry at the people who do the Metropolitan Opera because a particular production was void of artistic merit. And, you know, I should have been nicer. And I think that lady is going to know forever. Is going to remember what I said to her in the hallway there.
Well, it's not productive to get into arguments with individual members of our readership or
That's
audience.
That's right, and I want to publicly apologize, wherever she is, to that lady.
We were telling Mike before we went on the air that although we have 20 pages of notes here, we may not use them.
We never get to
But
them.
You just hit on something that I was going to ask you whether we could talk about, because I had started reading about a controversy involving the Metropolitan Opera and this fella Gelb who runs the opera.
Yeah, he's the head guy.
He's the head guy, the son, I believe, of a former New York Times managing editor.
True, all true.
And there is a media element to this back of the hand question. He runs this place apparently with a very tight ship on a number of levels. You know this because you play the Metropolitan Opera, I believe, on the air here.
Yes, we do.
Yes. And he is, among other things, is trying to control reviews. He is not allowing
That's right.
reviews. Can you know
as
more?
As I remember it, what happened was that they own a magazine.
Oh, that is their own, the Opera News.
Yeah, I think it's theirs.
Okay.
And they have had fierce independence up until now. And they have been giving the back of the hand to several of these Metropolitan productions. And the editor has recently announced, or the publisher, we are not going to be covering Metropolitan performances anymore. So, you know, you have to watch about the hand that feeds you.
Yeah. He's a tough bird, I guess. A tough, I'm going to use that.
I wouldn't want to mess with him.
Yeah. And as I recall, when we were talking about your use of the opera on this air, which does not get a lot of financial support from listeners, if I'm correct in that. You can,
that's pretty correct.
In advance of the fund drive next week.
Yeah.
When you have the fund drive, you must play the opera in its time frame.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's
so
part of
one
the...
Sunday, Saturday, in the last fund drive, we had to play the opera, and I think it lasted 6 hours.
That's a requirement of the agreement
you have.
Yes,
the contract.
Have. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that by the time this particular Saturday was over, I think we had made the least yeah. amount of money that we've ever made in recent times.
Yeah, so it wasn't even a question of had you played the opera. You had to play the opera, but all the opera fans would be happily contributing to the station.
They wrote me and they said, you're not fair to pick on us because we're at the opera watching it or at one of the many theaters that are now playing it, watching it. And I said, then lady, why do we have to have it on the air? You see?
Well, the Great Fund Drive begins Monday, and that will displace our program on Monday afternoon, although we will be heard on Sunday night, or are being heard on Sunday night.
Yeah.
But there will be an opera on Saturday.
No.
So, oh, there will not. Oh,
no,
great.
It's over for the season.
It's over for this, because I was going to urge the opera people to give early in the week.
I'm sorry, but we brought poor Mike on here. And
yes, I'm going to go to some topics right now. We have plenty of time left.
But I wanted to mention that the Mahewee Theater in Great Barrington, which plays the opera, has like 600 and something seats in it. Well, they sell out every one of those seats for the opera.
Heard that.
In the last fund drive, I couldn't get 617 people at any price to support the opera. And they have tremendous power because if you took it off, they'd be all over you, like ants on syrup. And they'd be yelling and screaming, why'd you do that? But they won't fork over unless they have to pay for it.
Hmm.
I thought I'd just mention that.
All right. Well, the Great Fund Drive is this week, and please contribute to WAMC.
Especially if you want to keep the opera on.
Yes, and the media project, maybe we can make it an hour if there's enough push for that. All right. Okay, media birthers. I'm going to fall into the trap because I'm going to ask the question, why is the media still talking about the birther issue, which is whether or not the president was born in this country. It seems to me, and I think to most people, that that is an issue that should be over. The birth certificate has been presented. The facsimiles of the birth announcements in the Honolulu newspapers have been shown. Yet the issue continues. It came up again in a controversial interview with Wolf Blitzer with Donald Trump on CNN. The press secretary of the White House, Jay Carney, claiming that media organizations or certain media organizations are to blame for promulgating this. And I have some statistics that I can go into, but Mike and Alan, why, including us right now, are we still talking about the birther issue? Is it a legitimate news story this far along in the cycle?
Well, while Jay Carney blames it on cable news networks, the interesting thing, according to the Project for Excellence in Journalism, which is a nonprofit that tracks such things, most of the talk has been on the liberal MSNBC. Twice as much time has been devoted to talking about the birthers issue than Fox News spends on it. So it's a red meat issue, isn't it, Alan?
That's what it is. Look, imagine everybody, you are running one of these stupid cable things and you're in a fight for advertisers and you wanted people and you say, what are the red meat issues that will bring us certain constituencies? Well, we know one of them is sex. Any kind of sex will do it. And then, you know, divorces and titillation and that kind of thing. Then the other thing that is bringing a constituency is all the Obama haters. They want them. They say, okay, if we start talking about the worst thing that we can say, even though as an article of faith, it's just that they don't like Obama, so they're going to cling to this stupid thing, and we're going to get them as viewers, and they get them. It's disgusting, I tell you.
But Mike hit on the statistical point. That first of all, the statistics do show that the cable news networks are the ones that are keeping this alive. But one would think, by extension, that Fox News would be the one that's really talking it up. Yet the statistics by this organization that keeps track of this sort of thing says that MSNBC, when it was talking about Obama, was talking about the birthers 92% of the time. When Fox was talking about Obama, it was only 8% of the time. And when CNN was doing it, it was 100% of the time.
Ira, let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
You read the Daily News, you read the New York Post. They're obviously engaged in a tremendous war. The question is, which one puts the sexier woman on the front cover or the second page in order to keep up with it? It's not because these editors are sex maniacs. It's because they know it's going to sell papers. That's what's happening there.
So you think that MSNBC, for example,
would like some of what Fox has? Yes.
Well, they're preaching to their audience in these particular cases, and they would claim the far left and the far right, and this issue apparently fuels the interest of those people on the edges.
Now, Mike, I welcome you to this program, and I hope that you're not going to be too insulted here.
Here it comes.
But I always tell my students, it's not what you know, it's what you don't know. So here you got Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch is not a friend of Obama's, that's for sure. On the other hand, you also have this incredible scandal that is every day claiming more people. I think over 50 people from the Murdoch organization have been arrested. Arrested, for God's sakes, in England.
And his own tenure is threatened by this.
Well, yeah. But
perhaps.
But in the end, the question is, when does it jump over here? When and if does it jump over here? And if it does, what is the Weltanschauung, the worldview of the Murdoch organization towards a sitting president of the United States who may well be reelected, may not be, but may well be reelected? Are there any entreaties? Does anybody lay back at a particular time because they don't want them to come full force at them if it turns out there's an opportunity to do so? I'm not suggesting to you, well, maybe I am, that this is the case. I'm just simply saying, how do we know what the intercourse between the news organization and politicians are and the subtle things that go on? Do you know?
Don't you think that if the Murdoch scandal in England was going to raise its head, it would have happened here by now? Are you suggesting at all behind the scenes that it is not because Murdoch is working back channels?
No.
No, okay.
No, I'm just simply asking questions.
Yeah. Well, what do you think?
Well, you know, some congressmen have threatened to open investigations into what's going on this side of the ocean. And I think if there is anything going on, collusion or any illegalities like what's going on in the U.K., I think it will come out. You can't hide that stuff. It'll come out. It may not come out before the November elections, but it will come out if they've been, you know, hacking phones or paying off politicians
So it all comes out. So, for example, we know who killed Martin Luther King. The King family doesn't. I don't. And I don't believe that jerk over there with a roll of money that they found with him when they arrested him. I don't think everybody's been thoroughly satisfied on everything that went around about JFK. I'm not a conspiratorialist. I'm just simply saying there are some things we never find out about.
You're listening to The Media Project. Ira Fussfeld, Mike Spain, and Alan Shartok. Well, you know, we talk about points of view and whether the Fox point of view, which is decidedly conservative, and the MSNBC point of view decidedly liberal, and whether or not the amount of opinion from is evenly dispersed in the public discourse. We have a report this week regarding a different kind of imbalance, and that is the amount of op-ed columns in the country's newspapers that are produced by females as opposed to men. That the opinion makers, the opinion writers in the country's newspapers, particularly the larger newspapers, are decidedly more men than there are women. And if you dig even farther than that, there is almost no representation among op-ed columns by Latinos, by Asian Americans, and by Blacks. And Mike, your role as associate editor does not put you in the position of choosing op-ed columnists.
But I spoke with Jay Jochnowitz, who was the editor of our opinion pages, and he feels that he is able to find qualified women to present diversity on our op-ed pages. That's the opposite of the editorial pages where we carry our columns. And he doesn't think it's too difficult to find women who have important points to make and opinions to express. But that does disagree with Sue Horton, who is the op-ed page editor at the Los Angeles Times.
Who?
Sue Horton. She is the...
You didn't get it, did you? Okay.
Okay. Dr. Seuss.
Sorry.
But She actually asserts, now this is anecdotal, this is not scientific, that one of the reasons that more men step forward, maybe 4 out of 5 of the submissions to her op-ed page are from men, is because men will be happy to express their opinion about anything. They don't have to research it. They'll just sit down and express their opinion. And women will often decline to write an op-ed piece because they don't have enough time to thoughtfully research it and make sure that the opinion is sound and that the piece really is defended. And that's her opinion. Before she was there, when a man ran the op-ed pages at the LA Times, it was criticized because only about 20% of the op-ed pieces were by women. And now it's only slightly better, and she's been there 7 years. So she just says it's the nature of women to be more careful, and men will be like give a cocktail party opinion and just write a little bit about it and move on.
Men are more bellicose, in other words.
Well, but, you know, I want to make sure I'm clear, and maybe you guys can help me out, because
sure,
I think of op-ed at our newspaper, a small newspaper in the Hudson Valley, we purchase through various syndicates a number of op-ed columnists, and we have quite a diversity on our page. I'm happy to say that a number of our professional columnists are female. Now, we do not accept nor print unsolicited op-ed columns. I suspect that that's what we're talking about here, as people who routinely will send in pieces to newspapers and the larger newspapers will choose to print them or not. And my impression is that that's the statistic that we're talking about, because when you look at the syndicate directories at the various companies right. that syndicate columnists, they're almost equal in terms of number of men and women.
Right. They offer professional columns that are produced regularly on schedule, and you pick them up, we pick them up, and we're able to maintain balance that way. But when the editor of the opinion pages opens his mail or her mail, according to these studies, 4 out of 5 are submitted from men, from over the transom by men, not women. Men are more eager to express their opinion, and women are not. That's what at least Sue Horton and some others have surmised.
Well, so that suggests to me that there is perhaps more balance on the smaller papers in this country than there is at the big companies.
You know, I've been sitting here listening to your self-praise.
Yes, I want to hear what you do in WAMC.
Well, SPS stinks. It's self-praise stinks.
Uh-huh.
It's not really all that healthy for you. Well, we certainly have a lot of female commentators.
You don't pat yourself on the back. Who's going to do
it? And we'll continue to do it. Yeah, well, that's right.
You do. Well, now, you do have unsolicited.
My hand can easily reach them, my back.
you have unsolicited, what you call, it's not Vox Pop.
Reader essays.
And those are unsolicited.
Yeah.
People phone them in. Do you clear them? How does that work here?
I basically, our editors handle that. I don't. A female editor, Katie Britton, does it, and I know that Joe Donahue takes a hand in it, and, you know, I've never had any complaints from anybody.
It would be interesting to see, and not to do a gotcha, but whether or not your experience with these unsolicited pieces mirrors what is going on, apparently, the big papers, okay, which is that fewer of those are coming in from women than from men.
You've primed the pump, you know, by putting more women's voices on the air, you've invited more women to submit their opinions.
That's so nice of you, Mike. I just know that if I find a PhD candidate who's willing to do this study, we'll be
You'll get right on it. Well, the other thing that's interesting as a result of this research is that it's showing that opinion in the so-called legacy media, which is the old line print newspapers, but also because of the proliferation of cable and all of the discussion and punditry there, that opinion is more important than ever in media in general, as newspapers and broadcasters trying to stake out their turf in this increasingly diverse and competitive world are doing it largely with more opinion than they used to.
I've been trying to point out to Rex for years that editors have regularly been subtly subjecting us all to opinion in the news.
The trend, perhaps, that many editors are talking about is taking on a bigger role and directing people rather than just do he said, she said, to take a step back and
walk. This is the way it is.
Right. And this is the way it is and instruct people on how to make important choices and not just try to pretend you're neutral, but to take a point of view. And that you're going to see more of. I think you see it already in some papers.
I like it.
Okay, well, that's it for this week. We thank you for joining us on The Media Project. I'm Ira Fussfeld with Alan Shartok and Mike Spain. And join us again next time on The Media Project.
For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra. Read all about it, it's a mess.